All right, it's time again for another edition of Drumination Live, the show where we talk about all things about drums, drumming, and drummers. And of course, I have my illustrious partner with me in crime today, Adam Nussbaum. Hey, Adam, how are you, brother?
How? I ask myself that question every morning. How?
I ask myself.
And I'm just glad I am.
Right, there you go. I ask myself, why? Why am I? But anyway, it's the first show of the new year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. I'd have to be a genius to tell you how, but amen that it just is.
You just are, man, and we're delighted you are. How was your Happy New Year? Belated, but first show of the new year, how was your holiday season?
Everything was nice. Everything was very enjoyable. Had a quiet night with the wife. Had a nice Indian meal. Went out to our local jaunt and stayed there till about 11:30. Then came home to watch the ball drop and probably was asleep about 5 after 12, you know.
Well, my holiday was miserable, and I'll tell you why. I got COVID. My whole family got COVID. Kevin had come down to stay with us from Nashville for the holiday. And by the day after, December 27th, we were all sick as dogs. And I tested positive. Took 12 days to test negative. So I had a miserable New Year's Eve was my birthday. New Year's Eve sucked. New Year's Day. And then I had to cancel my trip to New Orleans for the Gen conference where I was meeting up with my pals and buddies. And it took, like I said, 12 days of not very much fun. But, you know, if you can live together as a family in a house for that long with everybody sick, that says something positive, I suppose.
Nobody killed anybody, so, you know, that's a good thing.
No harm, no foul. We got through it.
Amen.
Anyway.
Amen. You're okay.
Thank you. He had to cancel a bunch of gigs here, and he's back up in Nashville now doing his thing. We were looking at show topics, and Adam said, you know, there's a lot of drummers with birthdays in January. And he was right. we're going to focus on like five key guys and see how much time we have. But let's just look at this list for a second, Adam. Some of these I got from you. You tell me if I'm missing anybody. Questlove, Jimmy Cobb, Phil Collins, Dave Grohl, JoJo Meyer, Gene Krupa, Dave Weckl, Paul Wertico, Max Roach. I'm only like halfway done. Kurt Biscara, Ansley Dunbar, Steven Adler, Nick Mason, Rob Burden, Ed Shaughnessy, Sid Catlett, Al Foster, Jeff Watts, Kenny Clark.
Whew.
Ooh, man.
If all you did was listen to those cats, you'd be in good shape.
I wonder what was happening 9 months before January that caused all these guys to come around.
Was Easter?
I don't know. Something was in the air. There's an old joke there I won't go to.
Okay.
All right. So let's knock these out. We're going to do like five of them. We thought we might do Gene, of course, Sid Catlett, Kenny Clark, Max Roach, and Jimmy Cobb, because they all sort of fit together in a certain genre. And we'll see how much time we have with that. But the first drum star is this guy here, Gene Krupa. And I'll let you fill in, Adam, from there. What do we owe to Gene?
Well, Gene, first of all, he had a great beat. And I think that's why initially he was an entity and a commodity to have in a band. And he was also somebody who brought the drums more to the foreground. You know, taking a drum solo, you know, the public generally see more than hear. They liked the way this cat looked. He was very presentable. He played very clear ideas. And he was also part of one of the first integrated groups, which was the Benny Goodman group that brought in Teddy Wilson and then later on brought in Lionel Hampton.
On Vibe.
And, you know, Gene was out of Chicago, and he was somebody who just helped to bring the drums more to the foreground with the general public. He was always very respected by other musicians as well. And he was a gentleman.
That's a good point about the general public, because he was also the first celebrity drummer. And he was in movies. He's the kind of guy, if he were alive today, he could go to a mall in Des Moines and people would know who he was.
Absolutely.
We don't see many celebrities anymore. And of course, the famous drum solo, you know, as you said, he brought to fore the extended drum solo. And of course, the one everybody cites is Sing, Sing, Sing with Benny Goodman.
Recorded
in 37.
Yeah, and written by Louis Prima.
That's right.
Who was another wonderful band leader, and a lot of people called him the Italian Louis Armstrong.
Mm-hmm. New Orleans guy, too.
He was from New Orleans,
mm-hmm.
and he was a fantastic entertainer as well as a wonderful trumpet player and a good band leader.
Mm-hmm. And so, he loved that double shuffle, two-handed, fast tunes, like Just a Gigolo.
Yep. Jimmy Vincent was the drummer on a lot of that stuff with Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And what was great with Louis Prima's band is the balance between him and his very extroverted style and Keeley Smith, who was also in the front line, who was very cool.
Super
and the balance.
Cool. He's jumping all around and and she's just like looking at him like he's crazy. She's super cool. And it was a perfect foil together. But
yeah,
Gene was the cat, man. And a lot of people still, if they had limited to one drummer, they would choose Gene. Now, he was overshadowed a bit by Buddy in terms of technique, but two different guys there, man. You know, Buddy was like the extension of Gene.
Well, I think these gentlemen grew up in that time where there was also somebody who wasn't born in January. There was Chick Webb,
mm-hmm.
who had a profound effect on many of these gentlemen. And I also think that, you know, Gene was in Chicago, and there was also Dave Tuff there. There was a bunch. I mean, as soon as I start naming some, I know I'm forgetting some.
Yeah, we can't cover them all.
Yeah, I mean, but Gene Krupa, he was extremely loved in the community as well.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a very nice gentleman. I think the movie that they made was like most movies dealing with the jazz topic. They made more of certain elements that were not necessarily that really important.
It's always negative in the jazz media, or whenever there's a movie. Miles used to talk about that. You know, it was always negative. He had a more profound way of saying it that I won't do, but you know, you always, even in the movies when there wasn't a jazz musician, if there was a seedy nightclub or something, or a seedy, you know, noir kind of scene, they would put jazz music with it.
Unfortunately, jazz by many is still considered a four-letter word.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality of the situation is it's one of the only true art forms that we gave to the world that originated here in the United States.
And not only that, the drum set originated as a jazz instrument. So
yeah.
I think if you're going to learn the violin, you know, you're going to go back to 16th century stuff. If you're going to learn any musical instrument and genre, you're going to go back and learn where it all came from. And in the drum set, it came from jazz, man.
Sure. I mean, we all have our biological fathers and we all have our musical fathers. And if you are serious about the instrument, you have to realize that it's not too much more than 100 years old.
Right.
And if you're a classical musician, like you said, you'd be going back 500-600 years. The people that came before us built the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be aware of that. I remember when Mavis Staples was getting the Kennedy Center Award. And she was part of the Staple Singers that was basically their father, Pops, with the sisters and everything and his kids. And she said something great, and I loved it. She goes, Pops built the foundation. We're just working on the building. And the people that came before us definitely built a foundation. And we're all a combination of the things that came before us and how we've all absorbed that information. Right. There was that great comedian that we would all know of. A lot of the younger generation may not. Milton Berle. And he was once quoted as saying, steal from one person is plagiarism, but to steal from many is research.
That's right. That's right. And I don't care if you're a death metal guy. You know, whatever your genre is, man, you can only learn from these cats. You can't take anything away from you by learning this stuff.
Absolutely. You know, it's very important to understand where things are coming from. And whatever you listen to, it's still going to come through your vision and the way you hear things and your point of view. So, I mean, you know, Gene Krupa had a great sound. He had a fantastic feel.
And that he holds also you in good stead in any band, right?
Bingo. Good sound, good feel. And if you've got some ears and you know how to listen, you're going to work.
Conduct yourself as a professional and you got the whole package.
Right. And these people were also affected by the ones that came before, you know, Baby Dodd, Zooty Singleton. You know, it's part of a continuum. So Gene Krupa was definitely somebody that was a major player in the whole game. Like you said, most everybody would know who Gene Krupa is, at least people of our age and
all right.
our parents.
Well, who's this guy?
Oh, this was a gentleman, Big Sid Catlett. Mm-hmm. And this gentleman had absorbed the things that had happened before him. And also, he's one of those transitionary musicians where he was also involved in some of the early bebop recordings. And he had a profound influence on people that came after him. Cozy Cole was, you know, he kind of came up along with Big Sid. But Max Roach, Philly Joe Jones, these people were very influenced by Big Sid.
He was known for his beautiful touch and dynamics.
Incredible touch. And I cannot recommend enough this recording.
Hmm. Tell us about that.
All right. This was done at Symphony Hall in 1947 with Louis Armstrong. And there's a song on here called Mop Mop, which is basically a drum lick that Max used to play. Max made it famous. A lot of people didn't know it came from Big Sid, that you've probably all heard. Buddy o pop, buddy o pop, buddy o pop, pop, bo bo, zilly o pop, zilly o pop, zilly. That was Big Sid, and that was a solo feature for him on this. And what's incredible is, I find it fascinating, he had such a beautiful touch and sound, and he could get so many nuances just from the snare drum alone. You could hear him. It was like he could have like a whole world of rim shots, all different colors, all different textures, and his ability to explore the options and everything that you could do just with the snare drum was amazing. And he's on, you know, he played with Louis Armstrong. He also did things with Dizzy and Charlie Parker, and it's a shame because he passed away from a heart attack, I believe, in 1951. And so, unfortunately, we didn't get to hear him keep on going. But right. What's interesting is a lot of these bigger gentlemen have a beautiful, light touch on the instrument. You know, he really understood the dynamics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he was a profound influence on people like Max and Philly and people that came afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is really a great recording. And, you know, for those of you that don't really realize it, Louis Armstrong probably had the most profound effect on popular music of anybody in the last century. Because without him, he changed everything.
Well, I'm in my 60s, and when I grew up, we knew Louis Armstrong as an entertainer, right?
Right.
Hello, Dolly, and the handkerchief and the smile and all
that. Absolutely.
But we didn't know until I learned later that he was probably the most influential musician in the world of the 20th century. And he was just that heavy as a vocalist, as a trumpet player, as a soloist, just a world ambassador for music and jazz. Pops, his nickname is Pops is Tops in my book.
Yeah, I mean, he always sounds modern to me.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the situation around him may not be, but this guy, amazing sound, amazing phrasing, his trumpet playing and his singing, you really can't separate them.
Right.
And, but I was like you. When I was young, I thought he was just like this big smile and the handkerchief and hello, Dolly. Then upon doing a little bit more information hunting, which we used to have to do and put more effort into than now, where you just ask Google or Siri, you found out this cat changed everything. And I think he's an invaluable, you know, person for people to check out. It's amazing. And, you know, he always had good bands. Mm-hmm. And Big Sid was somebody who could cross through the genres. He could deal in the Dixieland thing. He could deal within the swing thing. And then he got into the bebop thing. So that in itself is pretty impressive.
Pretty hard to do, yeah.
Yeah. And there are some recordings that were done later in his life when, you know, because the thing is, when these gentlemen passed away, recording technology wasn't as it is now and wasn't as it was in the mid-50s. So they were just beginning to get it together with knowing how to record drums and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think of who the artist is. There's a few recordings of him with a trumpet player where the sound is quite good. You might be able to find him on YouTube or something, but he's definitely somebody worth checking out. You know, beautiful feel, sound. And when he's taking a solo, you can also hear on the record, he's doing things that were visually interesting because you hear that crowd reacting in certain ways. So
right.
We have to remember, these people were not only great musicians, they came up in the time through vaudeville and things like that where it was more of a popular music. So there was an entertainment factor that was something to be considered.
Going back to Gene again, very much an entertainer, very much an entertainer.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, let's look at the next cat. Who's that?
Oh, man. Well, he's kind of called one of the fathers of modern drumming, and that's Kenny Clarke.
Mm-hmm.
Who came out of Pittsburgh. That's another town that had a very, very fertile musical environment, to say the least.
To say the least, yeah.
Yeah, and you know.
Kenny Clarke had the nickname Klook, which was short for Klook Bop, which was, what is that called, onomatopoeia or something? That's from bebop phrasing, right?
Yeah. Sure.
Moving the time to the cymbal and comping with the dropping bombs and all that. People didn't.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff was done, I think, at times by Joe Jones. But Klook really seemed to liberate the bottom of the drum set in such a way where the bass drum wasn't primarily playing four all the time. The time continuum was more up on the ride cymbal. And we have to remember what that name is, the ride cymbal. That's what the band gets on so they can play the ride. You want that ride to glide, you know? And Klook had a beautiful beat. I mean, fantastic. And he was somebody that then opened the door, and it continued on with, you know, people developing what he had started. You know, Max Roach had continued to do things like that. And, you know, Klook, this was fascinating how they're all kind of melding together. Things that Papa Joe did, things that Big Sid did, things that Klook did, things that then Max did. There was just a lot of kind of, I guess, cross-pollination happening within the tradition and the scene. So Klook is somebody that was just loved by so many. Everybody just loved how he had such a great swing and a feel.
Let's talk about that for a minute. You say a great beat. People talk about a big beat, owning your beat, great swing feel. How can we put that into terms maybe for younger players who don't know these genres? What does that mean, a great beat or a big beat?
Well, having a great momentum and flow in what's happening on that ride cymbal. The way it could just create a good feeling for the band. I only heard Kenny Clark play live for 4 measures.
What was that?
Oh, man. I was playing in Paris at a club called the New Morning, and it might have been 80 or 81. And Klook was playing around the corner from where we were playing at a little club. I can't remember the name of it. And I rushed after my gig to go down to see him. And as I was going down the stairs, I heard him going, And as I got down into the club where he was, the cymbal was just ringing. They had finished.
Oh.
There's some fantastic videos of him playing. And he's just somebody that had a profound effect on everybody. And everybody that played with this gentleman loved how he played. They said he had a cymbal that when other people would sit in and play it, it sounded like a garbage can, but when he played it, it sounded like he was playing a piece of crystal.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Yeah, like Tony Williams had a great specific dry K sound when he was with Miles, but there are some recordings of him in Europe playing Paiste cymbals, which are, no slight on Paiste, but they're sonically opposite what we know as Tony's sound, and he sounded like Tony.
Well, you know, there's that old expression, it's the painter, not the brush. You can't get too crazy with the gear. And you have to figure out how you're going to develop your sound, your touch. I mean, everything about how the sound comes out is going to be directly related to the kind of motion and grace that you have playing the instrument, learning to play it. Not, of course, we strike it and we hit it, but you want to play it. You don't want to, you know, it's like that term that people use for the bass drum, the kick drum. Are we kicking that?
I hate that term. Yeah.
I'm totally with you, man.
It's a musical instrument, man. We don't kick it. We don't beat a drum. We don't kick a bass drum. We play them.
Right. Musically, I understand
with sensitivity.
In the studio, when guys are like talking back, you know, to differentiate between a bass player and the bass drum, they may say the kick, but I don't like that.
Yeah.
And the thing is, learning how to get a nice sound on the instrument. I mean, we're at a time now, things are very different. In the era that all these gentlemen came up, the basses weren't amplified. Basses had higher action so they could project. They didn't have pickups. They didn't have anything like that. Drummers had to learn to play softer, be able to play under a band. Everybody had to learn how to get a great sound coming from them, not the microphone, not the amplifier.
Right.
And so there was a certain discipline that was required. That's why guys knew how to play brushes well. Mm-hmm. They knew how to get different textures and understand that. And
they knew how to feather the bass drum. You know, when people say, well, they played four quarter notes on the bass drum, it wasn't boom, 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 boom. It was a very soft, subtle sound that matched perfectly to round out the bass that was soft in the mix so that the two of them together made a propulsive, rhythmic thing of beauty, and you didn't come away hearing thud, 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 thud.
Well, the bass player would smack you upside the head if you're stepping all over his zone.
That's right. Also, the drums were tuned open. It wasn't like, you know, those right. kind of contemporary kick sounds.
It's very different. It was very different. You had to have a sonic match with the timbre and the quality of how the sounds work together. I mean, I'm always telling, you know, whenever I do a workshop or something and I see the bass player and the drummer, I said, you got to get a nice blend between the spittle-a-ding and the ickety-boom.
I love that.
It's necessary. And a bass player is the BASE of the sonics in a group. Nobody else is down there. You have to stay down there. You got to stay in the lower register to help support a group. If you want to play in the upper register, that's for solo time.
I think so, but as well. Yeah. I don't like to see when somebody's walking, stay down on the down there, you know. That's your zone as a bass player.
When everybody's getting excited and going up, you got to go down. You got to balance out what's happening. And
Good point.
Yeah, I mean, for me, if a bass player can take a solo, that's frosting on the cake.
Right.
My first thing is, how does it feel for me to play with them?
Same thing about the drummer. If they can solo, that's icing. That's great, but that's not why you're there.
Right. I mean, you know, 90% of our job is being an accompanist, at least for me and what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to help everybody else sound good. And the thing to realize is all these musicians here that we've mentioned today, I'm saying musicians first, not just drummers. They were musicians first that played the drums. They all worked because they had gained the trust of the other musicians. And you want to make music with people. Very important.
That's something that's been kind of overlooked during the pandemic, when nobody could get out and play. The gigs were gone. And people were playing in their own rooms, their own spaces. They have this great sophisticated stuff to record audio and video. And that's terrific. But nothing is like playing real music with real people.
It's a social event. It's something where people have to get together and try to find, like I always say, I want to find kumbaya with everybody when we're playing.
Mm-hmm.
Where we can get along and try to make music. And these are the factors that were present in, well, anybody that's working and whose name you see consistently out there, that's why they're there. Because first they're talking about, and their main priority is playing with each other. And it's on that great recording that Baby Dodds did, talking in drum solos. You got to play for the benefit of the band. Thank you. That's it.
Thank you. That's it. All right. Here's another one that's probably more influential than, well, I don't know more, but some people consider him the father of modern drumming.
Well, Max Roach. I mean, this was an incredibly gifted young man. He came, you know, he was in Brooklyn. He was on the scene. He was there. And he was able to hear those people like Kenny Clarke and Papa Joe and all these people. And then we also have to remember the advancement of the drums and how people played had a lot to do with what kind of changes were going on in the music. It's one thing works with the other. They don't just exist independently. And Max was somebody who really developed the aspect of the independence with the snare drum and the bass drum, really took it to a high level. And also, as a soloist, was such an organized thinker, and amazingly thematic. And, you know, what can you say? You know, he was playing with Charlie Parker. You know, Charlie Parker was one of the innovators.
And he was still kind of up to his death, too.
Absolutely, yeah. And Max is one of the major figures in the music. I mean, undeniable, for sure.
My favorite record. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, the band that he had with Clifford Brown was amazing.
That's just where I was going. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you want to study drum soloing, musical drum soloing, check out the Clifford Brown, Max Roach. They're on the label MRC. And it's required listening, and it will teach you so much about form and structure. One of the things Max did was before, you know, there used to be a time when everybody left the stage and the drummer went nuts. And, you know, everybody had soloed. It was the drummer's turn, and so he played a solo until he or she was done, and then hired, you know, brought the band back in. With Max, and in that era, in the bebop days, they started improvising on the form of the song. So that if it was a 32-bar song, the drum solo is going to be 32 bars or 64 bars or whatever, and the musicians would have to count, know where they were. And if you listen to Max, it's so structurally sound and melodically wonderful that the construction of it is unbelievably sophisticated.
He's amazingly clear, very symmetrical. I almost I've referred to him sometimes as like the Frank Lloyd Wright. You know, things are very concise, very clear to very clear. And Max was also somebody. Well, he did an amazing. He did a great record, and this is a fantastic record. Mm-hmm. Max Roach, Drums Unlimited, and on this recording, he does several solo drum pieces. One of them is called For Big Sid, which is inspired by Bodiopop, Dodiopop, Bodalobop, Bop, Mop, Mop, the Mop, Mop. And the way Max constructs it, it's totally it with a song form, A, A, B, A. He plays that for the A section. He does an improvisation on the B and A. And he's totally working off that motivic musical idea where it's melody. He's making a melody with the rhythms. And then he also did another one on there called The Drum Also Waltzes. Mm-hmm. And these are clear. These are like songs. And if you listen to them enough, like anything, you can sing along. It's well, so clear.
I saw Max Live do a 45-minute set by himself. And it wasn't to a drum audience, you know, it wasn't a PASIC convention or anything. It was normal people who were at a jazz concert. He was the opening act for Gene Harris. And he held the crowd, man. They weren't drummers because it was so structurally sound. It was music in, all the way through. You knew where you were. You knew where it was going. You knew it was a whole piece of music that just happened to be performed on a drum set.
Absolutely.
He did it for 45 minutes and he held it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this man, he did so much to open up the possibilities of things that could be achieved. This is a very smart individual. And he was also somebody who was very socially aware. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't seen it, I would recommend definitely that documentary that just came out on Max, which you could search out and find. These are documents that, you know, the younger musicians definitely should check out. And Max had a profound influence, I mean, on so many people. His clarity, his articulation was exceptional. I mean, he's amazing in the fact that he could really have some stuff going on at fast tempos. He could really play fast.
Really?
And he also had a lot of vocabulary. And you can hear how he incorporated it in a very musical manner. You know, his things are very structured, very, very orderly, you know, very different. He's more of a vertical improviser, where somebody like Elvin might be more horizontal. Almost like if we would talk about Coleman Hawkins, the way he negotiated the tenor saxophone player chord changes in relation to Lester Young. Mm-hmm. You know, Coleman Hawkins hit everything more vertically. Lester Young was more horizontal. And all these factors are elements that contribute to how you may want to think about improvising on songs and things like that. But Max truly could make it sound like a total musical instrument. And The times that I saw this gentleman play were breathtaking. And I heard him play with his own groups. I heard him when he was playing with all-star bands. I heard him do some solo things. I heard him with that great band that he put together called M-Boom, which was an entire percussion ensemble, which was great. So these are people you have to hear. Did you lose me?
I'm losing audio, Adam. My wireless is running out of juice or something. Limp along, because you're not hearing me break up, are you?
They say breaking up.
Let's go to the next guy while I figure this out. And this is the great Jimmy Cobb.
Absolutely.
If you could take that for a minute, I'm going to see if I can fix this.
Okay. Jimmy Cobb, great drummer. He's out of the Washington, D.C. area. He came on the scene. I think he played with the saxophone player Earl Bostic. He had been working with Dinah Washington. And then he was also involved with Cannonball Adderley. And then he probably got his most notoriety when he came in playing with Miles Davis. And Jimmy Cobb had some beautiful clarity. You can hear the Max Roach influence in a lot of his ideas. He had a swing. It wouldn't budge. You know, his thing was right there on the money, extremely consistent. He was part of one of the great rhythm sections in jazz with Paul Chambers and Wynton Kelly. And one of those records that I think everyone should be aware of are the records, Miles Davis Live at the Blackhawk. That's a fantastic band. And Miles had that knack of knowing how to put bands together like nobody else and the balance of characters together. And Jimmy Cobb, anytime I would hear him, I'd be vibed right back to Live at the Blackhawk. That's great. There's the great recordings with Wynton's trio with Wes Montgomery, Smoking at the Half Note. And then later on, Jimmy went on to play with Sarah Vaughan, and just one of the greats. And he's a January drummer, and he's a D.C. drummer. And another great D.C. drummer is Billy Hart. Mm-hmm. We share the same birthday. That's November. And there's a certain way of holding the time that these guys have that's very special. And
Cobb
Jimmy
had a great sound, great time feel. That was right down the middle, man.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, any questions? It's right there. A matter of fact. And, you know, the great thing for me is I just feel so fortunate. I got to see Max a lot. I got to see Jimmy Cobb, and I got to have some interactions with these gentlemen. And they were all so supportive and encouraging. And you never forget that when your heroes end up just being so gracious. And, well, you know, what can you say? You know, that makes you feel so good. And Jimmy was fantastic. And he was still working up until like he was close to 90, I believe. And every time I heard him, he was totally consistent. This man was, you know, no messing around. I remember giving him a hug one time. He was like a rock, this cat. He was like tough, you know. Somewhere I have a wonderful picture of him with Peter Erskine and I on either side of him. And we're just beaming like a bunch of little kids, you know, very, very sweet. Jimmy was really, really something else. Wonderful.
Well, I had my changing headphones. I missed some of you. I presume you talked about Kind of Blue, right?
Well, I didn't mention Kind of Blue.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad I brought it up. The most popular jazz recording ever, still to this day, is Miles Davis' Kind of Blue, and Jimmy Cobb was the drummer on that.
Yeah.
And was for many years the last surviving member of that band.
Absolutely.
And, it's a landmark recording. If you don't know it, you should. Kind of Blue, Miles Davis.
The one record I recommended for everyone to check out, which I loved, was Live at the Blackhawk.
Right.
Because they're also playing standards and things like that. And you're hearing them on a gig.
Right. And you want a gig, there's noise in the background, there's, you know.
Yeah, and there's a different vibe in a live gig. You know, it's different when you go into the studio. When you're in the studio, it's the controlled environment. And when you're playing in a club, there's another vibe happening, different feeling. That, and for me, I think the greatest way to hear people play is to, well, first of all, whenever you get a chance, go see somebody play live.
Right.
Because you never forget what it's like to be in the room and feel that. And the air moving and the molecules and just the, there's no substitute for it.
I would add to that, the smaller the venue, the better.
Amen. Right? Amen.
You could go to Village Vanguard and sit behind the drummer in that little bench there, man. And
my jazz corner of the world.
Yeah. There's nothing like that. You're watching a great world-class drummer and he's 5 feet away from you, you know.
5 feet? Three, two, you can pull the hi-hat away from him if you want.
I know,
you're
I know.
That close. Yeah, it's valuable.
I do a jazz thing, a trio date a couple of times a month, and where we are on a stage, there's a four-top, a table, like the person is sitting right there. And you think that it might be too much for him. And I'll say, how are you guys doing? Is this all right? Oh, man, they love it because they're in it. It's right there in front of them, you know. It might be a little louder, but it's not going to blow them away. And they feel like they're in the band. It's a whole different listening experience.
No substitute for that, man.
Mm-hmm.
I feel so grateful. You know, I was able to sit next to most every living hero of mine. I could sit like next to them.
Right.
And, you know, you go there a night or two in a row and you're sitting there as like a young man and I'm practically drooling with excitement. Mm-hmm. The drummers know you're a drummer.
And they take you under wing, too. You know, that's what they're looking for is cats who really understand and dig and appreciate.
Okay, talking about Under the Wing, another drummer who we mentioned in the list, the great Ed Shaughnessy, who got so much visibility to the whole world being the drummer on the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
He grew up in New Jersey near Sonny Igo. They were kind of buddies. And Ed used to say when he was young, he used to go to 52nd Street. And as a youngster, he'd go see Big Sid. Big Sid used to let him sit in.
Well, I think Mel Lewis used to go sit right with Gene. Gene was sitting down right next to him, man, on the bandstand.
Yeah, there's nothing like that. Mm. And, you know, these are, it's all part of a continuum. And now that I realize that I'm in my third of this journey, I have to try to pay forward to the youngsters the stuff I was so fortunate to get from the people before me. And it's something. And, I mean, like anything, if you're serious about this music, you got to do some investigating. And it's very important. You know, a lot of times you may hear something on Spotify or whatever it is, iTunes or YouTube. If there's something you really like and it resonates with you, do a little investigating about it. Find out who's playing. A lot of times they don't tell you who's playing. Check it out. You know, this is important to know what you're doing. You know, don't come to a situation from a point of ignorance. Try to do a little bit of research. And
especially now in the information age, you know, you can find almost anything.
Yeah, it's crazy, but a lot of people don't do it. I mean, I know this young man, he said, oh, man, I was listening to the John Coltrane, and I really liked that drummer. And I said, well, did you see who it was? Did you check it out? He goes, no. And I said, Elvin Jones, check him out. I remember as a kid, I'd get a book, The Encyclopedia Jazz by Leonard Feather.
Yep.
I remember reading about Philly Joe Jones, and it said Philly Joe Jones because I heard the record Milestones, and it was like, wow, this guy's something else. And then it talked about him, who his favorites were. And I remember it said Big Sid Catlett, Cozy Cole. So then I went to check
them up.
And you go back and you hear the connection of this foundational continuum. So this is important stuff. Somebody I got to mention, another January drummer who's a personal favorite of mine, and just somebody who was always very encouraging to me and somebody I love dearly, is Aloysius Foster.
Mm-hmm.
Al Foster.
I never knew
Al him. Is great drummer, completely self-taught. You know, he used to, we'd hang out. He goes, yeah, man, I was listening to Max. I was listening to Art Taylor. And just, he's got a very unique approach that's coming from the tradition, but he found his own way. And he's got a fantastic beat, great sound. A great record for people to check out if they never did is a Blue Mitchell album called The Thing to Do, which came out in, I think, 1964 or so, 65. It was basically Horace Silver's band at the time. Blue Mitchell, great trumpet player. Junior Cook, bass player Gene Taylor, and a young piano player. You might have heard of him, Chick Corea.
Yeah.
One of Chick's first recordings.
I don't know that album. I'll have to look that up.
Oh, it's a great record, man. Fantastic. And Al, he plays an incredibly great groove on Fungi Mama. It's a great record. I mean, Al's like 19 or 20 on this record. Mm. And already he's got a great feel, great ideas. And a lot of people may only know of him from when he was playing with Miles, with more of that rock-oriented stuff, because he came in with Miles after Jack, right, where Miles was playing more backbeat-oriented stuff. But, man, Al had he's got a great deep pocket, great sound. And I used to go see him, and he'd have me sit in on gigs. And that's like jumping on a burning house. So it's like you had to go in there and take care of business.
You then better jump in, yeah. Both.
Yeah, you can't mess around when something like that happens.
All right, well, we've covered some wonderful drummers here. We're coming up to 50 minutes. And like we said, that's only a few, but something must have happened 9 months before January because some drummers were born.
I mean, and, you know, for some of you out there that aren't familiar with the names that we mentioned, Dave Weckl is January.
Mm-hmm.
Ainsley Dunbar, the great drummer who played with Journey originally, and then Frank Zappa, played with Jeff Beck, played with many people from Britain. Phil Collins is January.
Mm-hmm.
Dave Grohl is January. I mean, Jeff Watts, he's another great drummer. He's January. He's actually the same day as Jimmy Cobb.
You know who else is a contemporary cat, but he really knows his stuff, is Questlove.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. JoJo Meyer.
JoJo.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Questlove has done a great job producing things. You know, he's been definitely somebody who's helping to generate interest in the tradition and things that have happened, you know. And he's one of the drummers out of Philly. I mean, there's so many great, you know, it's fascinating.
That's a great town for drummers.
It's just fascinating. I mean, you could really do a whole show on each one of these people.
You could do a whole documentary on each one of these people.
Yeah. and there is a documentary on Max Roach that I would I believe it's called The Drum Also Waltzes. That would be something that everybody should check out. And, right, you know, Max, he once said something I thought that was hilarious. Great. He said, you know, for every three beats a drummer plays, five come from Papa Joe Jones. We got Cosmo.
I have a little Max story. I met him once. I was talking to him, and I said, did you ever have any trouble making those tempos back then? It was ridiculous. And he said, yeah. Used to grunt and fart and sweat and everything trying to keep those tempos up. He said, I was talking to Miles. This was back, you know, in the 80s. I was talking to Miles recently, and I said, Miles, why did we play that shit so fast? And Miles said, because we could.
That's right. I mean, fast is one thing.
Yeah, but
that requires working at it. You just can't jump in and do it. You also have to have the right mindset. Mm-hmm. As soon as you think something's like, if you think something, oh, that's so fast, you're in trouble. Yeah. Or, gee, that's so slow, you're in trouble. And you have to have that yin-yang balance thing working. When you play super fast, you got to think slow. One, two, three, four, one, two. And just like when you're playing real slow, one, two, three, four. You have to be able to keep that fast has got to be relaxed, mm-hmm. and slow has got to have momentum.
And slow can be just as hard as fast, man.
Oh, baby. Everybody's terrified of the space. But you have to feel that space the same way you feel the sound.
I did a session last year for this cat, and I'm walking in, and I'm loaded for bear, right? I'm ready to play. And first thing he puts up is quarter note equals 54.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, man, that's where we're going to be. You know, so I had to let all that energy, you know, you have to focus it, right? Still got the energy and the passion, but I had to come down from that, let's hit it, man, let's go, to that.
One, two.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's, but that's a real test.
Better be subdividing that.
That's a real test. I heard a lot of times when, you know, the horn players that would go to different towns and pick up local rhythm sections to check out where they were at, mm-hmm. they would count off like a one, two, mm-hmm. three. And if you could deal at that tempo, they knew, well, if he's together there, I'm pretty sure he's going to deal with it if we get a little more upstairs.
Ed Self tells a story when he was at North Texas in that famous 1 o'clock band that, you know, all the guys would come through town that come and visit the school. Joe Williams sure. came by one day and he says to the band, you guys want to play some blues? And he's passed out a chart and they go, yeah, yeah. You know, they're thinking more like, you know, Coltrane or something hot. And it's kind of like it's almost beneath them. Yeah, yeah, we'll play some blues. And he does that. One. Two, three, and the whole band just fell apart and was handed their asses on something that simple.
Never mess with the old cats, man.
That's right. That's
People
right.
see somebody old, they probably forgot more than we'll know.
That's right. Yeah. All right,
well, man.
Well,
Cosmo.
Yeah, I hear him. How's Cosmo?
You want to come on camera? You want to?
Yeah, he's a drum dog.
He's got his toy here. Come on. He's not cooperating.
All right. Well, he's
all right.
Dog world. All right. Well, we don't know what's coming up, but we're going to do these probably every couple of weeks. Adam's traveling all the time. He's a globetrotter and bringing his talents to the universe. So,
well, I'll put a little plug in. If anybody's around Chicago this Friday and Saturday, I'm playing at the fantastic Green Mill, which is one of the great clubs left in this country, and used to be one of Al Capone's joints. I'll be playing there with a wonderful trumpet player named Brad Good, along with Ernie Watts and a wonderful Canadian piano player, Adrian Ferrugia, and one of my favorite bass players, Mr. Jay Anderson.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to be there for two nights, and then we got some stuff up in Cincinnati the following weekend at the Cafe Vivace, and we're going to be doing something in Lexington, Kentucky, and something else as well in Cincinnati. So if you're out and about in the Windy City and parts in Midwest, please come out and hear some live music. Thank
you. Peterson used to say, we need you to keep reappearing so we can keep appearing. Something with that effect. Yeah.
Yeah. And I always make the announcement now at a gig when I look out and I see everybody around our age, I say, bring out the kids. Don't ask them, just grab them and bring them out to experience live music because there's nothing like it.
And they will
and
be
we need
quiet,
to
man.
Keep it going. To keep it, we need to keep it going to keep it going. That's it.
You know, when I had my cymbal company, we had a lot of artists from disparate fields, right? They weren't all jazz players, of course. And I would go here and play wherever they were when I could. And man, I never regretted it. It could be something just totally foreign to anything I had ever played in my life. Something I wasn't aware of or didn't even necessarily appreciate or feel great about. But I always loved a live performance.
you can learn about things you may want to do, maybe learn things that you may not want to do. Right. It's all part of the process. So, Michael, thank you very much for doing this. It's always a treat, always a pleasure. And everybody stay safe out there, and let's just hope for some peace in this crazy world.
Please, yes, I'll second that. And thank you again, Adam. And we'll see you watch where you watch, and we'll let you know what's coming up. All right.
Aloha.
Peace out.